Welcome to the Deep Dive. You know, here in Southeast Houston, for folks in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, this topic, economic development incentives, well, it pops up quite a bit.
It really does.
So today, we're digging into what these things, sometimes called subsidies, actually are. Wow. We've looked at some research, experts like Michael Lefebvre, Haywood Sanders, and there's a lot here.
Definitely.
So you hear about tax credits, abatements, subsidies. What's the basic idea?
Okay, so simply put, they're benefits provided by government. Could be local, state, federal level.
Right.
And they're designed to make it cheaper, maybe more profitable for, you know, specific businesses or whole industries to set up shop or stay put.
Like a special deal from the government.
Exactly. A special deal to attract or keep certain kinds of economic activity.
Gotcha. And I hear incentives, I hear subsidies. Are they pretty much the same thing? Or is there a difference we should know about?
For the most part, yeah, you can think of them as interchangeable. Their goal is the same: giving one company or industry a leg up, a competitive advantage.
Right.
Some people might get technical. Say a subsidy is more like direct cash, while an incentive might be a tax break, maybe easing up on rules. But honestly, the core idea, it's the same.
Right, right. So it's not just like cash handouts. We're talking tools like tax increment financing. Is that one?
That's a big one, yeah. TIF, they call it. Using future tax money to pay for today's costs.
And enhanced enterprise zones. Those offer tax advantages too.
Exactly. They're all just different ways governments try to give certain businesses a boost. Different tools in the toolbox, you know?
Makes sense.
And like one expert we read pointed out, even something like, say, Michigan funding tourism ads.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, taxpayer money there. It shares that same basic idea, using public funds to help out a specific sector.
Hmm. Interesting. So it's not like this is some new invention then. This has been around.
Oh, not at all. I mean, different forms have existed for ages, but the modern version, the kind we see a lot today, that really got its start back in the Great Depression.
No kidding.
Down in Mississippi, two towns, Columbia and Durant, they were kind of pioneers.
What did they do?
Well, their first idea was pretty clever, actually. Private citizens, local folks, they put up their own property as collateral.
Wow.
Yeah, to build factory buildings. The whole point was to attract manufacturers, get them to move there and create jobs. Offering them a building was the incentive.
So it started really local, private initiative. How did it become the, you know, the big public programs we see everywhere now?
Well, the mayor of Columbia back then, he later became governor of Mississippi, and he liked the idea, wanted to take it statewide. So that led to what's generally seen as the first industrial revenue bond program. Basically, cities could issue bonds.
Public debt.
Yeah, public debt to finance buildings or equipment for businesses, using public money as the incentive.
And Durant, you mentioned Durant.
Right. Durant's got a special place in this story. It was the first city where a company actually moved across state lines because of incentives. A hosiery company came down from Indianapolis.
So that was the beginning of the border wars, kind of.
You could say that, yeah. It set the stage. And now, industrial revenue bonds are everywhere. Super common. But they trace back to Mississippi in the Depression.
That's fascinating history. So once it kicked off, have people always thought these incentives were a good idea?
Oh, definitely not. Attitudes have gone back and forth, really. Over the last, say, 25 years or so, you've seen cycles. Federal, state, local levels, all over the place.
Like what?
Well, back in the 1990s, there was actually a pretty big pushback. People were calling for Congress to ban them. States were talking about making deals like compacts to stop poaching each other's businesses with subsidies.
So trying to call a truce in the border war.
Exactly. There was real worry. It was just destructive competition.
So what happened? Did they stop?
Not really. What we saw instead were these technocratic responses, as one expert called them, trying to make the deals look more accountable.
Technocratic.
Yeah. Things like putting clawback clauses in the deals. You know, if the company doesn't create the jobs they promised, they have to pay the money back.
Okay. That sounds reasonable.
Yeah. And things like getting executives to sign affidavits saying, yes, this incentive was the reason we came here. Trying to prove it was necessary.
The but for clause, right? Yeah. But for this incentive.
Precisely. And also, sometimes local votes, referendums, especially for really big, visible stuff like sports stadiums. San Francisco voters, for example, they shot down public money for stadiums several times.
Big projects get more attention, I guess.
They really do. But then, you know, things shifted again. In the 2000s, incentive use actually ramped up again.
Huh. Why?
Hard to say exactly. Maybe the pressure just built back up. It wasn't really until after the Great Recession hit around 2008, 2009, that some states, Michigan included, started trying to pull back again. Maybe the financial reality hit home.
What about those clawbacks, though? Did they actually work? Make companies pay back if they didn't deliver?
Well, the experience there is mixed. Maybe at first, companies were a bit more careful. But what happened over time, in places like Missouri, Texas, Michigan,
yeah,
companies often just went back and renegotiated the deal if they weren't meeting targets, avoided triggering the clawback.
So they're kind of paper tigers.
Often, yeah. There was sometimes this attitude of, well, it's a small loss among friends. Let's not make a big fuss. So the intention was good, maybe, but the follow-through wasn't always there.
It feels like there must be really strong reasons to keep offering these things.
Yeah.
Why do so many local governments, maybe even thinking about Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena here, feel they have to offer them?
Oh, the pressures are huge. Political pressure, managerial pressure, get this. Something like 95% of local governments offer some kind of incentive.
95%? Wow.
Yeah. Officials often feel like they have to, maybe just to look good, you know? Announce jobs, announce development, positive PR. Sometimes state law even pushes them into it.
That whole Amazon HQ2 circus really showed that pressure, didn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Remember that. Cities were falling all over themselves, offering billions. Even cities that realistically stood no chance. They felt they had to play the game, or they look like they weren't even trying to be competitive.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, Toronto kind of bucked the trend. They basically said, nope, zero incentives. Maybe they saw it as a race to the bottom.
Good for them.
Yeah. And some smaller cities, they were smart. They put in a bid, got some free PR, but probably knew they weren't really in the running.
It makes you wonder, though, if you have to offer special deals, doesn't that kind of admit your regular taxes or regulations are maybe too high or too burdensome? Is that the conservative argument?
That's definitely an argument you hear, yeah. If you need sweeteners, maybe the main course isn't appealing enough. It makes logical sense.
But is that how it plays out?
Not always, or at least it's not always discussed that way publicly. Often it just turns into this sort of mercantilist thing, you know?
Yeah.
A border war driven more by headlines and PR than maybe sound economic policy. Less about fixing fundamentals, more about winning the next deal.
So appearance over substance sometimes.
It can seem that way. And the research, it kind of backs that up. Studies have found that areas with higher taxes, they tend to abate more, offer more incentives.
Okay.
While areas with lower taxes tend to abate less. And historically, those lower tax, lower abatement places have often done better economically overall.
Huh. So if your basic business climate is good, you maybe don't need the extra deals as much.
That seems to be the pattern, yeah.
Let's talk more about that border war idea.
Oh, yeah.
Kansas City gets mentioned a lot, right, with the state line cutting through.
Oh, it's the classic example. Kansas versus Missouri, right there. They've spent hundreds of millions, literally, over the years.
Doing what?
Trying to lure companies back and forth across the state line. Applebee's moved, AMC Theaters moved, Waddell and Reed.
Mm.
Big names shuffling a few miles for a better deal.
But does that actually create new jobs for the whole region? Or just move them around?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Often, the net gain for the region is minimal, maybe even zero. It just shifts activity, highlights how incentives can just churn jobs locally instead of bringing in real growth from outside.
It sounds like companies have gotten really good at playing this game.
Oh, absolutely. They understand incentive shopping inside and out. It's strategic.
How so?
Well, a lot of times, a company figures out where it wants to be first for solid business reasons, workforce, logistics, market access, whatever.
Right.
And then they go looking for incentives. It's like the icing on the cake.
Is there proof of that?
Yeah, there's documentation. Groups like Good Jobs First track this stuff. There have been reports out of North Carolina institutions showing this pattern.
Wow.
There was even this infamous internal PowerPoint that got leaked from a major accounting firm. The title was supposedly something like, milking the cow.
Milking the cow. Seriously, who's the cow?
State government. It was basically a playbook on how to maximize the subsidies you could get.
That's pretty blatant.
Tells you something, doesn't it? And another thing, a major corporation actually listed the potential loss of government incentives as a risk factor to their profits in their official SEC filings.
So it's baked into their business model.
For some, it seems like it, which really underscores how important these subsidies can become, not just for location decisions, but for ongoing profitability.
It does make you wonder if it distorts things. Like, does it lead to bad decisions?
It certainly can. There was an interesting anecdote from Kansas City. A hotel chain was offered incentives to build, but they actually turned them down.
Why?
They said they felt the market was already saturated. Too many hotels.
Yeah.
Which suggests, you know, maybe the incentives were encouraging more hotel building than the actual market demand warranted.
So you get a glut of certain things just because the subsidy makes it look profitable on paper.
Exactly. It points to a potential lack of sort of long-term planning.
Which seems like a big issue. Instead of our communities, Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, having a clear strategy for what kind of development we need,
yeah,
it becomes just reacting to whoever shows up asking for a subsidy.
That happens way too often, unfortunately. Cities end up responding proposal by proposal, developer by developer, without maybe stepping back and asking, does this fit our long-term vision?
Right.
It's different from, say, how Detroit approached things back in the 60s. Their focus was much broader, big infrastructure investments as the core strategy, not just one-off deals.
This is a real challenge for us as residents then, isn't it? Because we see a new building, a ribbon cutting.
Yeah.
It looks like success. How do we see the other side of the coin?
That's the core difficulty, absolutely. Mm. The building is tangible. You can see it, touch it. What's harder to see is what didn't happen because the money went there.
The opportunity cost.
Exactly. That's the key concept. What else could that public money, our money here in Southeast Houston, have paid for? Fixing potholes, better schools, more police or fire protection.
Yeah.
There's a group, the Center for Economic Accountability, John Mazzina's work there. They try to actually put numbers on those opportunity costs.
Does that resonate with people?
Yeah.
The opportunity cost argument.
Research suggests it does, maybe more than just hearing the huge dollar figure of the incentive itself. Voters, especially independent voters, seem to react more strongly when you talk about the potential loss of public services they rely on.
So less, they spent $10 million and more. Mm-hmm. That $10 million could have fixed X miles of road.
Kind of, yeah. Or look at Kansas City again. You have these hugely successful, locally grown companies like Burns and McDonnell, Edon, Cerner. Cerner might be the biggest subsidy recipient there.
Okay.
And the argument gets made. Were their new headquarters built in part at the expense of, say, funding for public school kids in the area? It forces a tougher conversation.
It's harder when the trade-off isn't so direct, though.
It is. And, of course, the people and companies benefiting directly from the deal, they have a strong self-interest in promoting the upside and downplaying any costs.
Let's pivot a bit. Convention centers. That's a specific area where you see a ton of public money and subsidies, right? This could definitely affect us, with Houston having major facilities nearby.
Oh, yeah. Convention centers are a whole fascinating case study within this larger topic.
Where did that start? Publicly funded convention centers.
Well, public assembly buildings aren't new. Think about memorials after World War I, like in Kansas City and St. Louis back in the 20s and 30s, big public halls.
Okay.
But the big boom, the modern convention center race, that really kicked off in 1960. Chicago, McCormick Place, that was kind of the first huge purpose-built convention venue in the country.
And everyone else felt they had to keep up.
Pretty much. You literally had memos circulating between mayor's offices. Chicago's got this giant new thing. We're falling behind. It became part of urban renewal, trying to revitalize downtown.
What was the rationale? Why pour public money into these huge buildings?
The core argument, then and now, is attracting out-of-town visitors, conventioners. They come, they spend money in hotels, restaurants, shops. It's supposed to be a big injection of outside cash, boosting the local economy.
But isn't it kind of weird? Cities spend millions, billions building these centers, but they also seem to assume the private market will just naturally build lots of hotels nearby.
That is a peculiar disconnect, isn't it? You constantly hear about the economic impact. That's the justification.
Do these places make money on their own? Just operating?
Almost never. If you look at just the operating budget, ignoring the massive construction cost, nearly every publicly owned convention center runs at a loss.
Oh, how do they justify it?
It always comes back to that visitor spending argument. The idea is the overall economic benefit to the city outweighs the center's operating loss. And they often fund it with taxes that hit tourists' hardest: hotel taxes, rental car taxes, maybe restaurant taxes.
Ah, so they can say locals aren't paying for this.
Exactly. That's a very common narrative. It's funded by the visitors it attracts.
But those economic impact studies, you hear criticisms about those too.
Oh, absolutely. And for very good reasons. The standard method they use is often flawed.
How so?
Typically, they compare the economic activity with the convention happening to a baseline of basically zero. Like, if the convention wasn't there, the city would be a ghost town that weekend.
Which isn't realistic.
Not at all. Even without a big convention, hotels would have some guests, right? restaurants would be open, people would be doing something. The studies rarely account for that baseline activity. Yeah. They only count the new spending, and they often ignore displacement.
Displacement.
Yeah, like maybe locals avoid downtown when a huge convention is in town because it's crowded or prices go up. That can cancel out some of the supposed gains. They usually just report the big gross numbers, not the realistic net impact.
So if the centers themselves lose money and the impact studies are maybe optimistic, who really benefits from building them?
Well, several players. Politicians definitely like them. They're big, shiny projects, great for ribbon cuttings, showing progress. Developers, obviously, big construction contracts, lots of related development potentially.
Makes sense.
And then there's a crucial group, convention center consultants.
Consultants.
Yeah. These firms specialize in producing these glossy reports. They compare your city to others, usually find you're lagging behind, and surprise, recommend building a bigger, newer, better facility.
And their reports always show it'll be a huge success.
They tend to come with very rosy projections for attendance, hotel nights booked, economic impact. Again, usually gross figures, not net.
Can you give an example? Are those projections accurate?
They're often wildly optimistic. There's a famous example from Boston in 1997. The consultants predicted their new center would bring in 350,000 to 400,000 new annual attendees.
Wow.
And generate 789,000 new hotel room nights per year. The actual number in 2019, a pretty good year before COVID, 389,000 room nights.
Less than half.
Yeah. That kind of overestimation is pretty typical. A good rule of thumb, take the consultant's forecast and maybe cut it in half or even by two-thirds to get closer to reality.
So has any city figured out how to do tourism or conventions successfully without constantly chasing bigger subsidies and bigger buildings?
That's tough. Las Vegas always comes up, right? It seems successful.
Yeah.
But even Vegas. They doubled the size of their main convention center in the early 2000s. Did attendance double? No. It peaked before the 2008 recession at about 1.7 million attendees. In 2019, it was down to 1.2 million.
So bigger didn't necessarily mean better even there.
Right. And there's a strong argument that the whole convention industry was maybe flattening or even declining before 2020 hit. More cities building bigger centers, chasing a market that wasn't really growing much.
Meaning more competition for the same piece of pie.
Exactly. Which leads to intense competition. Many major centers were doing less business in 2018 or 2019 than they did back in 2006 or 2007, despite getting bigger.
So what happens then?
You get a price war. Centers start cutting deals, sometimes giving the space away for practically nothing just to get some activity in the building.
Like that story about McDonald's.
Yeah, the Orlando Sentinel reported on it. McDonald's was having a big franchisee conference. The rent was supposed to be something like $1.65 million. The final bill, zero. They waived the whole thing.
Wow. Just to get them there.
Just to get the hotel room nights and maybe some good PR.
So if the subsidy arms race isn't the best path, what are the alternatives? What could leaders here in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena think about instead?
The conversation is shifting, slowly maybe, but it's shifting more towards focusing on quality of place.
Quality of place, meaning?
Meaning the fundamental things that make a community a good place to live and work. Good schools, safe streets, parks, culture, reliable infrastructure. And, critically, a skilled workforce and good workforce development programs.
Sort of tend your own garden first.
Exactly. Sometimes it's called sticking to the knitting or setting the table. Create a fundamentally strong, attractive community, and maybe businesses will want to come without needing a special deal.
A fair field and no favors kind of approach.
That's the idea. Maybe that's more sustainable long-term than constantly trying to buy jobs.
Are any places actually trying this? Moving away from incentives?
We're seeing some signs. Austin, Texas has been getting maybe a bit stingier with big incentive packages lately. Tesla famously didn't ask for state incentives for their factory there.
Oh, interesting.
So the real test for Austin might be coming up with Samsung. They're considering a huge investment. We'll see how that plays out.
Anywhere else?
Memphis, Tennessee is another one to watch. There's talk that they might put their main subsidy program on hiatus, or maybe they already have. That would be a really significant move if it happens.
But for big cities, especially ones already deep in the convention game, it's hard to find examples of success without subsidies and expansions, isn't it?
It really is. Look at Austin again, even with their recent caution, they're still talking about a massive, like $1.2 billion expansion of their convention center.
Despite the trends we just discussed.
Despite the trends. Boston put a temporary pause on their expansion plan a while back because they weren't hitting the numbers they expected.
Right.
But it's rare for a city to just say, okay, we're out of this scheme completely. The political table, as one expert said, is just loaded with interests pushing for these projects.
Vested interests.
Yeah. Local consultants who do the studies, city councils who want to announce projects, state economic development agencies. Everyone's kind of on the same side of the table pushing for the deal. Sometimes even voters, you know, they want to see something happening locally.
Like that new hotel in Kansas City you mentioned earlier, the Lowe's.
Right. Big, shiny new hotel, partly subsidized. But now there are questions about whether there's enough business for it, given the potential oversupply, maybe made worse by subsidies encouraging too much building. And of course, nobody predicted a global pandemic hitting the travel industry.
Yeah, the impact of 2020 is still playing out, isn't it?
Huge unknown factor for all kinds of development.
Okay, so bring it back home. If our local city councils in Deer Park, LaPorte, or Pasadena are looking at one of these deals, a subsidy for a company, maybe even something related to tourism or events, what should they be watching out for? What are the red flags?
The absolute number one thing has to be opportunity cost. Always ask, what are we giving up to do this? What else could this money do for our community?
Don't just look at the potential upside.
Exactly. And demand a realistic assessment of the net impact, not just the rosy gross numbers consultants often provide. Remember, the consultant likely wants to get hired again. They're kind of like expert witnesses paid to make the case.
So challenge their assumptions.
Definitely. Demand analyses that include all the costs, direct and indirect financial and opportunity costs. Florida actually has an interesting model where they try to compare the impact of giving an incentive versus investing that same money in a basket of public goods like education or infrastructure.
That's smart. What else?
Scrutinize the consultant. Ask about their track record. Show us where your past predictions actually came true. Don't just take their word for it.
And specifically for those convention center or maybe hotel deals.
Same thing, but even more pointed. Ask the consultant, how accurate were your forecasts for city X, Y, and Z? Show us the actual performance data, not just descriptions of how nice the building is. Demand real empirical evidence.
Got it.
And critically, what is the downside risk? If those projections don't happen, and we've seen they often don't, what's the financial hit? Who pays the price? What services get cut? What happens if another 2020 event occurs? Cities owning hotels right now are facing huge challenges. Understand the risk before you sign the check.
So due diligence on the consultants, full cost accounting, and understanding the real risk.
Absolutely. Look closely at who you hire and make sure they count everything. And always, always check their past prediction accuracy.
That's really helpful. We had a listener ask specifically about a historical turning point. We talked about Mississippi and the Depression kicking off the business incentive competition. Was there a similar moment for the convention center boom?
That's a great question. While McCormick Place in 60 was a catalyst, maybe the bigger enabling factor for the explosion of convention centers was the shift towards using revenue bonds tied to those visitor taxes, the hotel tax, rental car tax.
Why was that so important?
Because in many places, issuing revenue bonds doesn't require a direct vote of the public, like issuing general obligation bonds, which pledge the city's full faith, and credit often does.
Ah, so it bypasses the voters.
It often makes it politically easier, yeah. It changed the game, making it simpler to finance these massive projects without having to sell the public directly on taking on huge city debt. You see it even today. St. Louis, Milwaukee, recently issuing bonds for convention projects without a direct public vote.
That really lowers the barrier, doesn't it? It changes the political calculation entirely.
Fundamental.
It makes you think. Maybe our local leaders should be required to attend business closings too, not just ribbon cuttings. Might give a more balanced view.
That's actually a really provocative thought. It certainly would provide a different perspective on the churn of economic activity, wouldn't it?
Well, thank you for taking this this deep dive with us today into this really complex world of economic development, incentives, and subsidies.
My pleasure. It's a lot to unpack.
It really is. We've covered, gosh, the history, the different types, the big debate over whether they even work, why opportunity cost is so crucial.
The specific issues with convention centers, the consultants.
Right. And the need to really question the claims and check the track records. So for everyone listening in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, we hope this gives you some things to think about when you hear about potential local deals or new projects in our neck of the woods here in Southeast Houston.
Yeah, ask those tough questions.
What's the real cost? Not just the sticker price, but the opportunity cost. What else can we be doing with those resources? And what's the actual history? Have similar projects worked elsewhere?
Really dig into it.
And here's maybe a final thought to chew on. Given everything we've discussed, how can we, as residents right here, best push for economic growth that's truly sustainable and benefits everyone in our communities? What should we be measuring besides just ribbon cuttings? What local numbers really tell the story?
That's the key question for local action.
Remember, Think and Act Locally is all about empowering you, the residents of Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, Texas, with information you can use to make a difference right here. If you found this discussion valuable, please consider supporting the show. You can find out how at thinkandactlocally.com/donate. That link's also in the show notes.